Hi everyone, welcome to the Ontology Summit second session of Track A, which is on reusable ontology content. I'm Mike Bennett, my co-chairs Andrea Westerinen and Gary Birdcross will be helping me as well. So I'm just going to run through some quick introductory slides, and we have a really good lineup of speakers today, so we'll give as much time as possible for them to speak and for discussion afterwards. So let's go to slide two, please. So just to reiterate the mission statement of Track A of this summit. So starting from the point that semantic technologies, including ontologies and reasoning-based applications, play a major role in the semantic web. And one recurring challenge has been the ability to make use of common semantic content and build reusable content so as to reduce the burden of new ontology creation and avoid the problem of having lots of silos of different ontologies that don't share common meaning, which would be a bit tragic. So, however, there's been a lot of challenges in being able to create reusable semantic content, both in terms of whole ontologies and individual patterns and other elements of semantic content. The challenge has been achieving some kind of commonality of meaning and being able to have reuse of ontologies. And that's really the challenge that this track has set out to address. So there are a lot of good foundational top-level ontologies out there. There's an increasing number of domain models from, finance and healthcare and so on. And yet the perception that we started with is that the amount of reuse seems to be quite low in practice. And so that's really what we're here to explore. So if we go to the next slide, please, slide three. This is our second session for this track. So what we've been doing is trying to get the questions out there and get different perspectives and so on the questions of reuse. What we have so far is really three sources of information that we're going to build on in today's session. So we have the presentations from our first session on 23rd of January this year. We've had a number of dialogues via email on the summit email server around questions of reuse and so on, and we've been maintaining a community input page to try and capture and pull together all of that information and different perspectives and ideas and so on. So the goals of this track is to try and define and document and set down what are the conditions for reuse of semantic content, what are the issues with reuse, try and identify useful concepts, reusable concepts and patterns and so on. The question of meta-ontology has come up as well, an ontology of ontologies, perhaps a bit ambitious, perhaps it's possible. That's the kind of thing we want to pull together here. We've been looking at approaches to modularization of ontologies, best practice in developing ontologies so they can be reused on account of their modular structure and so on, and looking at specific design patterns. We saw several examples of very similar event ontology design patterns, for example, in our 23rd of January session. So looking for that kind of exemplary content that can be reused in applied ontologies, also in semantic web, in linked data applications, reasoning-based applications, and big data applications. And part of the question we're looking at is how the requirements for reuse might differ between those different communities or different kinds of user, and we'll be hearing from a representative sample of those today. Another goal would be to think about what would be needed in things like the Open Ontology Repository and other tooling that would help to define and help people locate reusable content. Slide four, please. So what have we got so far? We've looked at some of the conditions for reuse of ontologies, some conditions that would apply regardless of the context in which you're reusing an ontology, such as accessibility, how much somebody trusts the source of an ontology, some interesting questions about how different ontologies might be built according to different theories of the world, or even different micro theories local to those ontologies. We've actually had there's some good thoughts on that at last year's summit as well, which we want to take into account. And then something we've tried to dig into is how requirements might vary for different use cases. So obviously a well-known use case in the semantic web is the ability to reason over ontologies. One question that came up on our January 23rd session is whether existing ontologies are actually built with sufficient semantics to support reasoning applications. If not, could that be one of the reasons we're not seeing as much reuse as we might expect? Conversely, if you're not building a reasoning application, should ontologies, do the constraints that hold for reasoning actually apply in the context of linked data and big data and so on? We've had some very interesting perspectives on that on the email discussions, and we hope to follow some of that up with some of today's speakers as well. Another main takeaway has been design patterns, in particular different patterns for event and how those fit into the micro theories that they're designed to work within. And then there's been takeaways and ideas on tooling, on governance of ontologies. If you're going to reuse an ontology, how do you know what its governance is? That's where the meta-ontology idea starts to come in. And some best practices, as I mentioned, in modularity. Also annotation. It was found that ontologies with better annotation are much easier to reuse because you have more confidence in what are the intended meanings and scope and so on. And then there's the elusive search for primitives. Are there ontologically primitive, archetypical concepts that can be reused and so on. So some of our takeaways today, slide five, a little bit more detail on reuse, and again this is from our synthesis of the thinking so far. Some of the issues of reuse are actually quite familiar from other areas of software engineering and not necessarily unique to ontologies. So there's some interesting parallels and some interesting differences as well in terms of software and data model reuse. And again, last year we actually saw some interesting approaches to assessing ontologies from the point of view of how they can be reused and so on. So for reuse, generally we want to try and capture the range of conditions and contexts and intended purposes for which an ontology can be safely and productively reused, and how one would track that the reused content does actually work as expected in the context of somebody who is trying to make use of that content. And that means trying to understand the different dimensions and the effects of modularity and other aspects on reuse across different contexts. For example, if you reuse something and some of the properties that are there may or may not be relevant to the context you're in, and things like change over time, if you're reusing somebody's ontology, is that part of some evolving set of ontologies and so on. So, and we've also found that there's different reuse questions around classes, you know, kinds of thing, if you like, classes of thing or owl classes versus properties and individuals. There's a lot of ontologies that contain extensional sets of individuals. And what about axioms, restrictions, and so on that make more rigorous statements about what it means to be the member of a given class. So all those different kinds of issues might affect reuse differently. So those are the kind of, you know, being able to target or make it easier to target what can be reused and how much transformation and cleaning up and so on is required. Next slide, please. Slide six. So one of the things that we've put out on the email conversations and the synthesis site is a set of 7 questions that we've honed in on, how to characterize and measure reuse both between ontologies and in the different communities of big data and linked data and semantic web and reasoning applications and so on, what building blocks actually exist and what might be needed to move forward with more of those, what's involved in the reuse of linked data versus the reuse of ontologies, are there any exemplary sets of semantic content that we as a group might propose for reuse, such as the event pattern that I mentioned earlier, possibly other more ambitious patterns. Is there any way of getting some convergence and agreement on these? Is there an example of a large set of semantic terms, a large ontology or group of ontologies that we might propose for reuse as a whole? Is it reasonable to expect reuse of an entire ontology such as Dolce or the Semantic Sensor Network? And if so, under what conditions do you expect to align, or can you precisely reuse that? And as we see the emergence of more large industry-led ontologies, that's going to become more of a question going forward. And is it about the reuse of the business meaning, the asserted semantics of the thing, or what about reasoning and data analytics and so on? Next slide, please, slide 7. So that's where we are so far, and what we wanted to do with this second session is try and take all of those lessons, and with the help of our 3 high-profile speakers that will be sharing their perspectives with us, we want to try and open up some of these questions, get perspectives from the linked data, from the reasoning, and other types of user of ontologies, and try and pull together some lessons on this, and some, as I mentioned earlier, documented approaches that we can recommend or try out. So that's the aim of this session: bring together the lessons learned to date, gain some new insights from today's speakers. So we have 3 speakers lined up. So I haven't been reading the chat, but I hope, yes, we do have 3 speakers lined up. Good. So we're going to be hearing about the historical perspective, so going right back to the beginning, the sharing of knowledge among both humans and humans, humans and computers, computers and computers, and so on. Then we'll hear more about the linked open data cloud, how to make sense of data, how to formalize data for deductive reasoning, and then strategies for reconciling heterogeneous sets of data, for example, on the linked open data cloud, by making use of shared ontologies. So this is, again, looking at how ontologies are reused in the context of linked data versus reasoning and so on. So after that, we'll have an open discussion where we'll try and flesh out what are the considerations of and requirements for those who want to be able to use semantic resources, ontologies and so on, and how to identify those. And conversely, when you're developing an ontology, particularly if you're doing it in a standard space, what are the things to think about when developing those for reusability? So slide 8. So our agenda then for today, covering those areas I just mentioned, is first we will have Dr. John Sower from VivoMind Intelligence, who will present on the historical historical perspectives on projects for knowledge sharing. Then we have Professor Michel Dumontier from Stanford, who will talk about the tactical formalization of linked open data. And then we have Mr. Kingsley Idahen from OpenLink Software, who will be talking about ontology-driven data virtualization. We have 3 speakers, so we're expecting to hit around 20 minutes per speaker, and that should give us time for a good, solid discussion after that. So I believe that's the last slide. So great. So do we, yes, we do. We have Dr. John Sower. I'd like to call on Dr. Sower now to give us a couple of minutes while you get your slides up. And when you're ready, over to you.
Okay, John. So the first title page says historical perspectives on problems of knowledge sharing, and I often update my slides from time to time when I get a new idea, so the latest version will always be at that URL at the bottom. On page 2, I summarized what's been going on with ontology research and projects for knowledge sharing, and they didn't really have formal standards, but there was a lot of talk about such issues over the centuries. And Aristotle had the de facto standard for ontology representations and the notation for them and the methods for reasoning for over 2 millennia, and that's his categories and syllogisms, which were taught in every university throughout Europe and elsewhere from about the 13th century to the 19th century. And in the that was based on a combination of Aristotle plus a lot of other contributors, and that was the scholastic logicians with contributions from the Latin and Arab and all the other groups. But around about the 16th century, there were a whole bunch of new schemes that were being introduced by Descartes, Mersenne, and many others. I'll talk a bit about those. 18th century, more of them. 19th century, much more on logic. Also, one critical thing, a very popular introduction, was Roget's Thesaurus and Boolean algebra, modern science, philosophy of science, and the early mechanical computers. In the late 19th and early 20th centuries, then we got first-order logic, set theory, ontologies by Peirce, Brentano, Meinong, Husserl, Leshnevsky, Russell, Whitehead, etc. 1970s, and then I'm jumping ahead to the computer era, where we had the databases and knowledge bases and terminologies of the 1970s. 1980s, we had Psyche, WordNet, and the Japanese EDR project, very large projects that have had an enormous impact on what's been happening in the last 20-some years. In the 1990s, there was a lot of research projects trying to build things together, bring things together, the Shared Reusable Knowledge Bases, SRKB, which introduced KIF and KQML and the projects that led to Common Logic. There's work on an ISO conceptual schema, the semantic web, and now in the 21st century we have lots of useful terminologies, but no universal ontology. And so I'd like to discuss the issues relating to this. And slide 3 has the challenge, namely the Tower of Babel, with all the languages that break down into incomprehensible versions. And on slide 4, I think it's important to mention the world's largest formal ontology, because this is the direction Psyche pioneered a lot of the directions we'll be talking about, and in many ways they're still far ahead in terms of developing a huge formal ontology. They're farther ahead than practically anything else. And after the first 25 years, there was one millennium of person years of work. And in the past several years, they've added even more to that. And there are some good applications, but the fundamental problem is that Psyche, like many of these other systems, are not well integrated with mainstream IT. And the next slide shows a picture of Psyche at the Cleveland Clinic, and I'm not going to go through the details there, but you can see that there's a huge amount of different kinds of things that are being combined. There's relational databases, there's the Psyche language, there is SQL, there's Sparkle, there is various things that they import from the semantic web and various other sources, and then there are all the application projects that they have to interface with. So there's a huge amount of different things that are interacting. And at the bottom is the URL of the report from which I took that diagram. And the problems on page 6 are that all these tools are processing variations of the same semantics, but with major differences in notations and methodologies. And I spoke with a man who was working at the Cleveland Clinic there, and he said there's a very steep learning curve for IT personnel to try to use Psyche, And one of the people signed on, I see, is Terry Longstreth. Well, I knew him from way back at IBM and at a conference at IBM in 1980, where we were talking about such tools. We had a lot of deja vu all over again. Any one of those tools by itself is a tremendous aid to productivity, but any two of them together will kill you. And that complaint, unfortunately, is still what's happening at the Cleveland Clinic and at many, 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 many other places. These things just aren't integrated. And we really need better tools, interfaces, and methodologies. One of the points that I make is that the experts in any field spend years to become experts. Their time is highly valuable. They don't have time to learn our tools, but they do have a lot of tools and notations of their own. What we should be doing is using their notations, not forcing them to use our notations. When you bring in a high-powered expert, the amount of time that expert should need in training is zero. They should begin to work on day one using their notations, their terminology, and not the kind of notations and terminologies that the computer people try to force them to use. And then there are issues of supporting interoperability. And the point that I make is legacy systems have been interoperating for over 50 years without having any formal semantics. And that is a challenge. What we should do as the oath that the physicians take is do no harm. We shouldn't make things more difficult by introducing semantics. We should actually make it simpler. Unfortunately, as the previous examples shown, a lot of these new things that we bring in make things harder. They don't make things simpler, and that's not the right direction to go. Well, to go back to history, here are Aristotle's 10 categories. And note that for every category, he had a question word that goes with it. And that's a very good point, because that means that you can use this as a guideline to the people who are writing your ontologies. You can tell them that for every category on the ontology, there's a question word, and the answer to that question is something that belongs in that category. And here's an example of describing George Washington using Aristotle's 10 categories. So the first category, called substance, that's the based on the Latin translation of Aristotle, and the question is, what is it? The answer is a man. The relation toward what? And the answer is a general of the U.S. Army. Quality, what kind? Handsome. Quantity, how much? Tall. Activity, doing what? Talking. Passivity, undergoing what? Listening. Condition, having what? Victory in battle. Position, how situated? Mounted on a horse. Place, where? Yorktown, Virginia. Time, when? 19th October, 1781 at 2 p.m. Now, that illustrates a nice pattern that is a fairly usable form, and it illustrates the reason why Aristotle's syllogisms and his ontology were so popular. It's possible to teach this to somebody. Basically, the first-year students at every university for 600 years were learning these things, and they learned them pretty well. Here's a tree of Aristotle's categories. Aristotle did not organize them in a tree, but Franz Brentano used this tree.
Okay.
And slide number 10. 9 was the describing George Washington, and slide 10 is Aristotle's categories. And the 10 categories on the previous list are at the end point, and Brentano added the linking categories by taking terms from Aristotle's Greek, translating them into German, and I translated them back into English. So there are the linking categories that link the 10. Now, for the patterns that relate to categories, Aristotle and the later logicians had a very nice, very clean set of four basic sentence patterns, which you could state in controlled Greek, controlled Latin, controlled Arabic, and controlled natural languages of any kind. And they labeled them A-I-E-O. There's the four sentences, very simple sentences which anybody who knows the language can read immediately. And here's an example. The They had patterns of syllogism. This is on page 12, slide 12. The first pattern, named Barbara, has three vowels, A, which indicate three type A sentences. And an example is, every quadruped has four legs. Every elephant is a quadruped. Therefore, every elephant has four legs. This is the syllogism that defines inheritance from one type or class to a subtype or subclass. The pattern named Darii has the sentence types AII, and that inherits from a type to an individual to a particular item. So, for example, every mammal breathes oxygen, some sea creature is a mammal, therefore some sea creature breathes oxygen. And then the negative syllogism, the first one is named Celerant, that has patterns EAE. No animal with lungs, this is slide 13, no animal with lungs is an oyster. Every mammal is an animal with lungs, therefore no mammal is an oyster. And then the negative syllogism, Ferio, no herbivore eats meat. Some mammal is a herbivore, therefore some mammal does not eat meat. Now, these patterns give you basically the main core of any kind of ontology, and in fact, just those four syllogisms, together with the kind of hierarchy that Aristotle defined, give you basically the most widely used subset of OWL or any other logic for defining ontologies. That the syllogism named Celerant, notice that the pattern E, no animal with lungs is an oyster, that's the declaration that the category of animal with lungs is disjoint from the category, class, or type of oyster. And then when you say every mammal is an animal with lungs, that's where you say that the every mammal is a class, subtype, subcategory of the category animal with lungs, and therefore no mammal is an oyster. And so you use these syllogisms for stating your constraints on the hierarchy. And it gives you a very simple, very easy to read notation that your high-powered expert that you bring in can immediately read without taking a course on how to use whatever ontology language you're using. Venn diagrams were invented by John Venn in the 19th century, and they're another very popular notation that's taught at the high school level and widely used for showing patterns. Venn used them to show, to represent the types of sentences you have in syllogism. So every A is a B. Corresponds to a pattern where you have a the shaded area of the A says there are the shaded area says that area that is empty. That says that the white area contains everything that's in A, and it says that everything that's in A is also in the overlapping circle B. And Aristotle assumed that every category that you define has at least one member, so that that X there represents the one member that it has, and it says that it's in that pattern. And then some A is B, that says that there's an X that's in the intersection of A and B. No A is B says that A and B both have some X. However, the intersection of the two is empty. They're disjoint. Some A is not B. That says that there's something in A that is not in B. So, and then there's an X that's on the borderline that says this X that is not in B could be could also be in the overlap of A. It could also be out. There, that is a very nice, simple way to show in a simple diagram everything that you can state in any of those controlled Greek, controlled English, or whatever dialect you want, and you can also describe them in a nice diagram form. And then can go to the next slide, 15. And the important point here is that Venn showed how you can use those diagrams for drawing the inferences. And so that this shows the, I won't go into the details here, but you can work it out yourself, that here is the three overlapping circles represent the entire syllogism Barbara. Every A is B, every C is A, therefore every C is B. That means that everything that's in C, the only white part in C is nested in both A and B. And then the Dari, the Aristotle, proved that some of the syllogisms could be derived from others, and in particular, Dari is derivable from Barbara, and you can show that with the Venn diagram that to show that every pattern that satisfies Barbara will also satisfy Dari. And this is a very interesting, basically it's a model theoretic way of showing that the syllogisms are sound and that the proofs that derive from them are valid proofs. So that's a nice innovation, and it shows how you can combine a very readable controlled English or controlled natural language thing with a nice set of readable diagrams, and you can use that for specifying ontologies or a major part of your ontologies in a way that anybody can understand with little or no training. Now, in the 16th century, the books in modern languages were being printed in the newly invented printing presses, and they were rapidly displacing Latin. And so everybody recognized that they needed a new universal language that all educated people in Europe, at least, could speak, or at least read. And Francis and Bacon claimed that Chinese characters were a good example because they were a universal set that could be used in different languages. It was recognized that Chinese characters were also used by the Japanese and by the Koreans and Vietnamese, and that people with different languages could read the same texts. And so a large number of famous philosophers and mathematicians and scientists jumped on that bandwagon and started saying what we need is a universal set of symbolic characters for a universal language that people could use for business and commerce and philosophy and everything else. And John Wilkins was the secretary of the British Royal Society, and he designed a very interesting scheme, which is very worthwhile looking at. It has features that are actually not yet incorporated in many of the ontologies people are defining. This is Wilkins' upper-level ontology, and he had a two-way partitioning between transcendental and special. And then he had five categories or six categories shown here of general, relational, mixed relation of action, discourse, creator, and world. Those have large subtrees that go off elsewhere, and then under this thing, under special, he had the creator, namely God. That was a unit class that only had one item, and then there was the creatures, and under the creatures, he considered them both collectively and distributively, and that's an interesting innovation because by collectively, what he meant were sets or classes or organizations that included multiplicities of these things, structures, and so on. And this is an innovation that a lot of ontologies today still don't include, namely the distinction between the collective things and the distributively, he had substance and accident, and under those, he had all of Aristotle's 10 categories plus many, many others. So his total categories, he had a totality of 40 higher level genera and 2,030 species, which was a fairly decent sized ontology. And the point is it's developed in the 17th century, and a lot of updates could be added to it, but it was still on page 18. It's an impressive combination of an upper-level ontology, a meta-level ontology. That whole branch called transcendentals is the branch where it talks about the things that are in the branch called specials. And it includes a thesaurus, a lot of that other members of the Royal Society added about 15,000 English words as approximate synonyms for those 2,000 categories. And so it was a kind of a thesaurus organized in a something very like a WordNet, but with some interesting philosophical principles underlying it, including Aristotle's syllogisms and a lot of others. Now, the
5 minutes, John.
Pardon?
5 minutes.
Okay, I'll wrap this up quickly. Okay, so the point is that that there's a lot of interesting things there. Unfortunately, it also had a lot of ad hoc features that were ridiculed by Jonathan Swift and Jorge Luis Borges. But on slide 19, I have an updated version of Wilkins' ontology, which shows that you can update that. At the top, I put being, and instead of transcendental, I said signs. On the left side, all of semiotics, all of the languages, all of the metadata are on that side. And then under physics, everything that exists in the physical world is there. And I replaced the creator with the laws that govern the world. And theists can think of the laws as the logos, which John the Evangelist, my namesake, by the way, said is God. So the laws equal the logos, and if you wish to, you can equate that with God. So physics is branched into the laws and the observables, and under observables, you have a very nice ontology. It's I'm not going to say this is the ideal ontology, because I don't believe that there is any such thing as an ideal ontology, but this is certainly up there with among the best. I won't say it's the best, but I would say that it's hard to find others that are better and that are as inclusive. So can any ontology be complete? I would say no, and I'd follow Alfred North Whitehead. Systems, scientific and philosophic, come and go. Each method of limited understanding is at length exhausted. In its prime, each system is a triumphant success. In its decay, it is an obstructive nuisance. And I'd make some point about thesaurus versus ontology. Peter Roget was a secretary of the Royal Society, just as Wilkins, but 100 or so, 200 years later, and he developed a thesaurus of words instead of an ontology of things. And this was a much simpler classification, but it was much, much more successful. His first edition of 1852 was an instant success. By 1869, he had 28 editions, and his son continued the work, and we're still using it today. And WordNet is in some ways closer to a thesaurus, and WordNet you can compare to Wilkins' ontology. And I would say that actually Wilkins' upper level is probably better than the upper level of WordNet. And then we can continue on. The conceptual schema work was an attempt to bring together standards that would enable interoperability. Well, that didn't quite work as well as people had hoped. And that was proposed in 1978. We never had one. There's the Unified Modeling Language, UML. This is another example of some very readable notations, which should be widely considered for ontologies. Very nice readable notations that can be used for a lot of ontology. And I would say that the only thing that I object to with UML is that there's a finite number. I believe that you should have an open-ended number of notations of that sort and include in them whatever diagrams and notations any expert requires. So I would say that for an expert, the expert's notation is the best. And rather than forcing experts to learn another notation, you should design your logics to support it. And then there's a lot of work about relating language to logic, organizing a large ontology. And on slide 27, I have a slide about old-fashioned knowledge acquisition. And when I drew this slide, I actually was sympathetic to the idea, but I've come to the idea that no, this is a dead end. This is the version that was being promoted in the 1980s, where you have the knowledge engineer has to work with a subject matter expert to get the knowledge into it, and both the knowledge engineer and the subject matter expert are very expensive people, and having both of them just doubles the cost and adds too many people. I don't believe that this is an appropriate way to do knowledge acquisition. A better division of labor is to have a system that can acquire this knowledge from structured data, training examples, unstructured natural language, and occasional questions, and communicate with people in any notation they prefer. and that both there's still a role for subject matter experts and knowledge engineers, but I would not say that you have to have both of them working together. And migration path for the future, and then in final slide number 30, is an observation of Immanuel Kant, and that the point that I make from his observation is that we need tools that can play the role of Socrates, that help us to discover the implicit knowledge and use it to process the huge volumes of digital data. So that, in a nutshell, is my view of how all of this history over the past 2,400 years fits together, and how what we can do about it for designing better systems that with better logics and ontology that all of us can use.
Thanks, John. That was a very powerful overview of the landscape we're in, and some interesting reminders for those of us that are perhaps reinventing Wilkins ontologies sometimes, I think. So I think that's a great high-level view to take us to feed into our discussion later. So thank you very much. So next we have Professor Michel Dumontier, who will be speaking on the technical formalization of linked open data, by discussing the challenge of working with Schema Lite and various strategies to make use of that data. So, Michel, over to you. Thanks.
Okay, well, thank you very much for this invitation. I've sort of summarized a little bit some of my thinking in the research work that we've been doing over the last couple of years as to how do we best make use of linked open data. So, slide two, please. So, linked open data, I think, is one of these really incredible experiments where people are creating structured forms of information and they're sharing it on the internet in a way that I think really hasn't been done before. And so because it's a very early experiment, we're learning as we're going along. And a lot of us are making mistakes and we're learning from our mistakes. And in the end, we're getting better and better at doing at making data available and interlinking data. And I think the primary success is really that this can be done in a very distributed manner, in an relatively uncoordinated manner. People are creating this infrastructure, creating the resources for others to reuse. Next slide. So BioChartF is one of the projects that I lead, and the idea is to create linked open data for the life sciences. And the primary, what we end up doing is we take data in a variety of formats, whether it's tab delimited files, relational databases, XML files, random flat files that people create, and we turn that into RDF linked open data. So we generate, we have an open source project where all the scripts are to do the generation so that people can modify them and contribute back the improvements on our scripts. That anybody can reproduce the work that we do. And I think that serves as a sort of a baseline project for how we should be thinking about this shared infrastructure. It's something that people ought to be able to reproduce or modify as they see fit. So we provide that. We provide the raw data outputs of the conversion process. We usually do the conversion process once a year. And we load these into triple stores. Currently, we're using Virtuoso technology, and you'll hear from Kingsley next. And we serve this up as linked open data so that you can take the identifiers for the resources that we've converted, put them in your browser, and get back information. So you don't need anything special other than your browser, and I think that's another one of the major benefits of having this. And moreover, we make the Sparkle endpoints available so people can do queries, but they're really just demonstrative. And the idea is to sort of expose people to this new, paradigm and bring it, allow them, give them the experience so that they can play with it and then bring it in-house for their own research. Next slide. So the thing about RDF, I think, and linked open data is that it's really simple in its conceptualization. This idea of having a simple triple, a subject, a relation, and an object, means that pretty much, I don't know, everything that we're thinking about we can put into a simple statement. And the nice thing is that with such a low barrier to creating this, we see this enormous linked open data map emerging from it. And I think that's really exciting. And so we have this ginormous proliferation. But one of the problems is that it's relatively uncoordinated. So next slide. And this lack of coordination makes open data, this linked open data, really quite chaotic and unwieldy. And we see, you know, information that is contradicting each other from different data sources, and they're represented in different ways. And so making sense of this hairball is currently, I think, one of the biggest challenges that we're facing, and is maybe an expected for some outcome of this lack of coordination from the initial part. But at the same time, I think it shows that that people, given the freedom, will create really interesting solutions that we can all learn from. So it's an opportunity for evolution of the representation and linking of information. So next slide. At the same time, with the data itself, just the mostly factual assertions, we're also seeing a huge proliferation in ontologies and vocabularies. And extending from what Dr. Soa was saying is that I think different people have different conceptualizations about what's important in the world and what they want to represent with it. And so BioPortal is one of our key resources in the biomedical domain. There are now, 378 ontologies. We see ontologies being added every single month. And we have enormous numbers of terms and mappings between that. In the more general sphere, we have the Linked Open Vocabularies Project, which is tracking vocabularies. And there are links between them and the sort of conceptual overlap between them. And we see lots of resources that are very similar to one another, created by different communities. And so this in itself, next slide, is exciting, but also, again, poses a problem. Not only now do we have diversity at the data level, but we also have enormous heterogeneity in the conceptualization of what those data are and what how we should even think about them. So despite all the data, it's still really hard to find answers to questions that we might have using terminology that we're all familiar with. When we ask each other questions, we can make the interpretation and we can find the information that we think is relevant. But here in this case, we have people who are typing their data in particular ways, and it's not necessarily a shared conceptualization. So it takes some effort to integrate these and make it more coherent so we get all the answers that we would expect to get if this were a more coordinated system. So the challenge is that this uncoordinated aspect leads us to have enormous numbers of different kinds of representations for the same data, and that people and the data sets themselves do it differently. So next slide. So for BioTRDF and another project that I'm involved in, which is to integrate semantic web services. We use an ontology called the Semantic Science Integrated Ontology, which we're just actually getting published now in the journal Biomedical Semantics. But we use this ontology primarily as a substrate for semantic data integration for the BioTRDF resources. And so on this slide, you can see an example where in the ontology we might have a term called gene. And we can then map this gene concept to the gene concepts that are defined in each of the data sets that we have in BioTRDF, whether it comes from the online Mendelian inheritance in man or a disease database, where they define a gene concept, or the PharmGKB, the pharmacogenomics knowledge base, and they also define a gene concept for some of their data. So in this way, we can formally relate the concepts that are defined in those data sets to our data set. And this really constitutes a really simple mapping process where classes and relations are typed to those that we have in SIO. And ultimately, that allows us then to pose questions using SIO terminology across the different data sets that we have. So next slide, number 9. Here now, we just have a screenshot that shows a segment of the cost hierarchy, a segment of the relation hierarchy, and a view, this is using Protégé, a view of one of their concepts, which is isomer. And so we have, you know, good axiomatic descriptions of these concepts. We try to describe them, and I think that's one of the nice things about description logics, is that we, in contrast with just something like the RDF schema, where you might just have taxonomies that are being manually asserted, here we have the potential to describe these concepts and use a reasoner to do the classification task and try to build up the taxonomy based on the descriptions that we provide these terms. At the same time, you can use this ontology given good descriptions and the inclusion of a negation and disjointness to validate whether or not the data itself is conformant with the conceptualization that embodies the ontology itself. And so in this project, what we try to do is articulate, I guess, ontology design patterns where if you're going to instantiate this ontology, if you're going to use this as a schema, then we have a certain way of representing information. And we can then check and see whether or not people are conformant with that. So next slide. That's slide 10. So here's an example now where using sort of the latest developments in the Sparkle and RDF, we're able to pose a question using terminology from SIO against the data, various data endpoints, the various Sparkle endpoints. And in BioTDF, every data set has its own Sparkle endpoint. And so we can say, well, I'm interested in finding, you know, chemicals and proteins that participate in the same process and basically span at least two resources in order to do that. Okay, slide 11. So while on the surface this looks really nice, the problem is actually that even in BioTDF, our representations are not, let's say, uniform, that in some cases the data that we have, we're just articulating a simple entity data type attribute and value. So one single triple to represent, for instance, the volume of a particular protein. In another data set where there might be much more information about this particular attribute, the representation might be more extended. So we might have a relation between, for instance, a protein and a volume, and then so you have a relation between two instances of these two types, and then you have a relationship which might be a data type relationship to the value, and then a pointer to the unit, right? So you have a slightly more a detailed representation of basically the same information. And then in the third model, you might have another data set where they make the distinction between the qualities of a protein and measurements of those qualities. And so you add another node, let's say, between the two values. And so we see this kind of heterogeneity even in the data sets that we produce, because the emphasis in BioTDF has been we'd want to just quickly and dirtily, let's say, convert data into RDF without having to basically look up what anybody else is doing. So more rapid RDF publication. So you can see that the problem here is that when you go and pose a question to retrieve this volume information from different data sets, you're going to have to pose several queries. And that's obviously a bit of a challenge. So slide 12. So basically, the long-term, I think, goal is really to encourage communities to help define what a standard representation ought to be. And that should be done by, you know, stakeholders that have a vested interest in both the provisioning of the data and having people use it, as well as the users themselves who, they want efficient representations. They don't want things that are, for instance, philosophically inspired, but rather are practically focused and focused on the data that they're interested in processing. And so we have to have this combination of community engagement. At the same time, there has to be a good knowledge of knowledge representation, and what are we actually going to be able to leverage if we bother doing this effort? So slide 13. So in contrast, and it's ironic because, you know, I chair this Semantic Web for Healthcare and Life Sciences Interest Group, and part of the work that we are doing right now is trying to gather communities together to establish these standards for data, for the metadata standards or data representation standards. And it's just a long process, and it requires that it be long and engaged, and that we hear from everybody, and that we synthesize guidelines that people will want to follow. And I think that's a very different approach than if you're just a user and you want to get in there and you want to use this information. How should we best do that while none of these standards really currently exist? And so what I'm proposing here is that we look at another option, which is this tactical formalization, where we take the data that you need and you're represented in such a way that it directly serves the purposes that you have in mind. And so an example that I'll walk you through is this discovery of drug and disease pathway associations, slide 14. So a biological pathway is basically a biological objective, which is defined by a series of interactions. And so, for instance, a well-known pathway, biological pathway, is glycolysis, which is a pathway that converts glucose into pyruvate, and one of the main energy drivers for the cell. Next slide, 15. So what we asked, we wanted to ask two, I guess, biological questions. One was, can we identify pathways that are associated with particular disease or classes of disease? And can we identify pathways that are associated with a particular drug or a class of drugs? And we wanted to basically use the data that we have in BioTradeAF to answer these questions. Slide 16. So what we did was we identified data sets that were pertinent, of interest, and we identified Drug Bank, PharmGKB, and the Comparative Toxicology Database, CTD. And each of these databases, they make reference to different terminologies. So we have MESH, this anatomical therapeutic classification, KEBI, UMLS, NOMED, ICD, and the disease ontology are all being referenced for both chemicals and for diseases. And so the goal was really, let's try to semantically integrate these terminologies so that we could potentially use any one of them to do our task of query answering or our data mining. So the next step was to formalize this information. And then we did a subsequent step, which was a discovery step, in order to find the significant associations between drugs and pathways and diseases.
Okay. 5 minutes.
So, yeah, slide 17. So we use the Web Ontology Language, or OWL, to do this kind of formalization work, to convert the representation of the linked open data as well as the terminologies into a coherent representation. So slide 18. And so part of the rationale here is that the RDF triples that we have are basically very underspecified bits of knowledge. And what we want to do is we want to make a commitment as to what these triples really mean. So, for instance, if you have a statement like nucleus part of cell, it begs the question, do you mean that every nucleus is part of a cell? Are there only some nuclei that are part of cells? Is it that cells always contain nucleus? Do they only some cells contain nucleus? And so on. So there's a lot of unanswered questions about this statement. And OWL is one of those languages that gives you a little bit more vocabulary to sort of define what it is that you meant. So in this case, the interpretation is that basically for every instance of a nucleus that you would expect that to be part of some cell. So we can formalize that as an OWL axiom here described using the description Manchester DL syntax, where nucleus is a subclass part of some cell. Okay, slide 19. So in this sense, when we look at data, linked open data, and especially when the subject and the object pertain to categories and you have some relation, then there's a number of different formalizations that you can create. And the right ones really depend on you knowing what it is that we're talking about, right? So you have some expertise in the domain, and you have to have some expertise in logic so you can put together the right axiom. And the problem is that I think when we look at ontologies, even biomedical ontologies, is that sometimes the intent is good in the sense that you have domain experts that create the content, which is the terminological content, but the formalization is wrong, meaning that the interpretation using the logic leads to an erroneous conclusion. And so it's a real challenge, I think, to articulate to domain experts what is intended, what is the actual meaning of some of the statements that they're formulating, or how should they be doing it. So slide 20. So what we've been doing is defining so-called axiom patterns for triples, where when we look at a particular data set and we look at the way that it is currently represented, we define a pattern which maps into this triple data set, and we turn that into a formalization or some commitment in OWL. So for instance, if we see this part of relation, so your X part of Y, then we translate that into an action pattern where for every X, there are subclass of something that is part of some Y. And so then we would translate these triples into these acts, these OWL action patterns, like nucleus subclass part of some cell. So slide 21. So I'm going to quickly go through the next couple few slides. But the idea here then is when we look at CTD, drug bank, and from GKB, is that we have pathways, drugs, genes, and diseases. We make these our disjoint top-level hierarchy. We then use the cost assumption to map the specific data items as subclasses of these top-level classes. We establish equivalence between the terms from the different terminologies using the mappings, the human-curated mappings that are provided. And we use other aspects of OWL that allow us to generate inferences based on the associations between that. So for instance, if you have a drug that is linked to a pathway, and that pathway is linked to a gene, then you have this relationship between the drug and the gene, but given that the gene is also linked to a disease, you have a relationship between the drug and the disease itself. So we can basically infer based on association new relations that haven't yet been stated. So doing this, we generate an ontology of 650,000 classes, 3 million subclass axioms, and 75,000 equivalent class axioms. And we can do some cool stuff. Slide 22. So one of the first benefits is that we have, I think, an enhanced query capability. We can use any of the map terminologies now to query any of the target resources. And moreover, we can ask questions with knowledge that are embedded in those target terminologies that aren't in the original data, right? So an example is here, we can ask for drugs that are associated with diseases of the joint because this information about the joint is in the target ontology of the disease ontology. So even if the original data was annotated with a UMLS term, because we have mappings to the disease ontology and that is axiomatically described, we can now query our knowledge base using that background information. We also learn relationships using the entailment that we have generated through the the ontology. So for instance, we discover that alcohol is associated with alcoholism, which is obvious, but only by virtue of the fact that ethanol is a kind of alcohol, and that's really where the assertion is between ethanol and alcoholism. Slide 23. So the knowledge discovery portion, like, while that's nice, and we do infer some potentially new associations, really, from a scientific perspective, we need to assess what is the significance of these associations. And so we developed a tool called OntoFunk, which helps us find the significant associations between sets of objects and ontological categories. And so this is a really well-developed field for us. And so then we can basically look and see, do we have significant associations between diseases and pathways and drugs and pathways? And and basically we find associations that we can't find in any single one resource, but can only be found by integrating these resources and the terminologies that go with it. Slide 24. So tactical formalization, I think, where you pick what you want, you build your own knowledge base using the formalization that you intend, is very promising. It begs the question whether or not, in terms of reuse, it's not reuse in the sense that it's necessarily useful to other people, but you're reusing a substrate. You're making use of a substrate to answer a particular question that you have in mind. And I would argue that this effort, having this in mind, is certainly much more rewarding, certainly from a scientific perspective at the current juncture that we're in, versus longer-term efforts, which I think are to try to synchronize these data resources together and to encourage a common publication standard. So for us, we've been using OWL formalization as a way to identify mistakes in human-curated knowledge, to identify conflicting meaning and terms. And so when we're trying to do this integration, we see that people don't mean the same thing, and we can identify those discrepancies, and we can try to either repair it or to avoid it in some way. And that ultimately this kind of huge mashup is going to give us an opportunity to, I think, refine what it is that we know about certain things with greater confidence. And so the single assertion now is maybe to be taken with a grain of salt unless you can find other such assertions being there. And so more probabilistic models of representing knowledge, I think, are going to become increasingly valuable. Okay. So finally, slide 25, I just want to acknowledge, so I have two students, Allison Callahan and Jose Cruz Toledo, who are my graduate students who have been working on Bio3DF. Peter Ansel has been responsible for getting the web front end for Bio3DF and has been helping along there. And then the work with Aberrant Pathways has been done with my colleague and collaborator Robert Hundorf and Georgios Koupos. So finally, slide 26, just want to thank you for your attention and looking forward to having a discussion about this.
Thanks, Michelle. That was very interesting, and I think those last few slides in particular feed in very nicely to the conversation that's going on the chat. So I think we'll have plenty to talk about in the discussion session later. So next we have Kingsley Idahan, who will be speaking about ontology-driven data integration and big linked open data. So looking at how ontologies are being used to address heterogeneous data virtualization. So welcome, Kingsley.
Hello, everyone. Good afternoon. Thanks for having me. So I think we should crack on and let's sort of walk through the slides. And as Mike explained a few minutes ago, I'm going to walk you through what's actually happening in the realm of linked open data in regards to leveraging the power of ontologies for heterogeneous data integration. So if we go to slide 2, I think we're all very familiar with the linked open data cloud, which is a living organic example of big data in the context of the World Wide Web. So, you know, this particular constellation, so to speak, of data has been on an exponential growth curve for pretty much over 5 years. And so even this particular depiction is sort of way out of date. But anyway, it gives us a basis to work from. Slide 3. And this is the situation, well, it's slide 2, pardon me, numerically. And that's the situation analysis. So, you know, I think the meme of the day outside of, say, this community or the semantic web and linked open data communities is big data. So there's a general acknowledgement that, you know, data is voluminous, it changes at ever-increasing velocity, it is inherently varied, and these three factors alone still work within a tiny window that's fixed, and that's a 24-hour window. So in a sense, we're all challenged as enterprise members or as individuals to hone our agility, to calibrate our agility in line with this reality. So we've got to be better, smarter, faster, knowing we only have 24 hours to deal with these three factors that are each increasing exponentially due to the effects of the World Wide Web and computing in general. To slide 4, please. Now, the situation for ontologies is equally challenging. Every time I come across ontologies in my travels, you know, here are the constants. There's conflict about what an ontology is. There's conflict about notations for representing ontologies. There are conflicts about publication, inaccuracies and accuracies, subjectively. There are discovery conflicts, so some people, you know, work as though nobody else has a worldview and an ability to describe their worldview. And others simply procrastinate because there are too many worldviews and they don't know which one to actually adopt. And overall, you fundamentally have usage conflicts generally when the subject matter is ontologies. Next slide, please. Last year when I presented during a similar session, I sort of introduced the audience to the Linked Open Vocabularies Cloud, which is a complement to the Linked Open Data Cloud that focuses primarily on vocabularies and ontologies. And so one of the benefits of this particular service is addressing this issue of discoverability. So discovering that an ontology exists without starting from an ontology name. You could simply have an intuition that, you know, somebody must have described a person using a class, or somebody must have described an offer, you know, the everyday entities that we, you know, deal with in our real world. So classes must exist for those things, or sometimes you may have a sense of a kind of relation. So you know somebody must have described a nose relation for associating two people. Somebody might have created a class or subclass relation. So what the Linked Open Vocabulary Cloud does is allows you to discover ontologies through a variety of dimensions, so different elements. And you can actually type in, you know, simple text constructs such as knows, likes, dislikes, and so on, in order to eventually find all of the classes or the relations associated with your terms, and ultimately you end up finding an ontology which may or may not be useful to whatever you're trying to describe. Next slide, please. Now, here's the typical pattern that leads to the creation of linked open data. So linked open data meaning that an individual observes entities and the way various entities are related, but follows the principle that, as we do in the natural world, that every entity has to have a name, has to be denoted, and that the denotation of the entity is handled via the use of an HTTP URI. And the benefit of using an HTTP URI is that the denotation functions like a term, in that when you encounter the term, you can reference the description of whatever this term denotes. So the referent, a description of the referent of the identifier, is only a click away. This is what linked data is in a nutshell. The ability to inscribe entity relationships using the familiar subject, predicate, object pattern, what every literate person, irrespective of language, knows how to do, i.e. construct sentences. So this is digitization of what we all know how to do. The big challenge for us is getting the terminology and some misguided memes out of the way so that we can all coalesce around what we know how to do, and the fact that computers can finally act as a very high fidelity bridge to our minds, for better or for worse. Next slide, please. So when creating ontologies, distinct from simply creating data, it tends to go along this particular path. So you have a domain expert or somebody who is very interested in a domain or a world. And that world is described. So the entity types, the relations in that particular world are defined or described in an ontology and eventually published to the web. Unfortunately, even the process of publication, especially when publication has to conform to the underlying principles that drive linked data, we end up with a bit of a hurdle. But generally, this is the process. These are the steps that lead to the collection you see in the linked open vocabulary cloud, for instance, and anywhere else. Next slide. But we ultimately end up in the same place. You know, do I start my creation of linked open data with an ontology in hand? Or do I have to locate a perfect ontology before I commence that process? Now, The problem is that if we go back to the linked open data cloud, about 7 or 8 years ago when we started a DBpedia project, we had two reactions. One set of people said, yes, great, finally we can begin to understand what RDF is capable of delivering when you combine RDF with the principles of using HTTP URIs rather than simply IRIs, but specifically HTTP URIs as an entity denotation mechanism. Now, another school of thought looked at DBpedia and saw mass disorganization. Now, of course, yes, you have this interesting web of linked data, but once you begin to explore it, it is rife with inconsistencies and inaccuracies. You have property names, so in a typical example would be that you would have a relation that has a URI-based object, so, you know, the value of that particular attribute is a reference, and in other cases, it's a literal, all right? And this could be the same relation. And so, you know, some people saw those kinds of problems, and others just, you know, encountered outright inaccuracies. And so, in receiving this input from these two worlds or schools of thought, the predicament has been, where do you start? Because if DBpedia didn't exist, then you wouldn't have the nucleus around which this cloud has coalesced and grown exponentially. On the other hand, if we said put that aside and try to arrive at a perfect ontological representation of the world, where do we start? Even with Wikipedia as a base, that is an immense undertaking. If we are saying that some individual who I've never met or heard of in the history of mankind could successfully pull that off. And so what history has taught me is to encourage people to use a bit of both. So if you're passionate enough about something, and it can range from a social network to the things you like to a bad experience when you went on a trip, all the way to the fact that your professional training has made you a domain expert, I would encourage you to simply get down and start inscribing. And I think when you get to that realization, the challenge is which notation to use, right? And that's really been a problem over the years. And so what I've tried to encourage people to do is where relation semantics are really, really important, i.e. their expression and their comprehension, you should look to something that's readable, something that keeps the subject, predicate, and object roles in clear view when you are describing whatever you're observing. Now, if you are trying to automate what you're doing, so you're generating a program, and you have a favorite programming language or development environment, then what you can do is complement using something that's readable. So for instance, Turtle, I find as a very readable notation. You can combine the readability of Turtle and the programmability of something like a JSON-LD or JSON or CSV or whatever. And if XML works for you, you can use that too, right? But the key thing is to be able to start to scribble into documents and publish with ease. Next slide, please. So again, you know, slide number 9 is reiterating what I said. You know, procrastination shows up a lot because of the dual problems between creating or having a perfect collection of well-defined terms. Slide 10, please. Again, everyone who's been party to the Ontolog forums and similar forums, the issues are always the same for the ontology creator. You have terminology disputes, relation semantics disputes, notation disputes, And even after all of that, you know, you make your perfect ontology, nobody's using it because they can't find it. And then on the other side of the equation, there are people who simply won't do anything because they hear there is a perfect ontology somewhere, but they just can't find it. And maybe if they do find it, they can't comprehend it because of the notation that has been used to inscribe the descriptions of the worldview expressed by the ontology. So, slide 11, please. I don't know how clearly this comes through to you, but what I'm showing you is how I work. And I know a number of people have asked me over the years, you know, Kingsley, how can you be the CEO of a company, be so active on a number of mailing lists and so on? And my answer is that before I started this quest, I understood that I had to have a tool that allows me to at least pursue omnipresence, something that allows me to exemplify whatever I believe the virtues of this technology fundamentally is. And so I've always had tools first and evangelized after the tools have been, you know, developed, tested in a practical sense, and then, you know, perform what we call dog fooding, simply use those tools to do what they're supposed to do. So, for instance, in flight 11, you're looking at a standard interface into our Virtuoso product that allows you to look at your interaction with data using a file, create, and share pattern. So you're always thinking in terms of, okay, I have a document just like I have a piece of paper, and I am going to write either a single sentence on this piece of paper, or I'm going to write a collection of sentences, I have a paragraph. And ultimately, I may have a collection of paragraphs, and they make up a chapter. The fundamental thing is that the interface, in line with the very nature of the web, is about creating a very simple mechanism to hone into the basic intuitions of literate individuals. You know, we see things, we write them down on a piece of paper, we file them, and we have control over who has access to the file. In some cases, access is restricted, and in some cases, they're publicly available. And so when I work with ontologies, whether I'm writing one or building a meta bridge or mapping layer, I pretty much work this way. This is the kind of interface I work with. And then when I save my documents, that's when a parser would come into play, determine if I've made any syntactic errors in my inscription, and then give me an error and tell me what line number the error occurred in. You know, very, very simple, but extremely productive. Next slide, please. So I pasted, I don't know if all of you saw this in the chat window, there should be a number of links that I shared just before I started. So I will just paste a particular link, which is the thrust of what I'm going to discuss next, which is really a practical example. Now, I believe most of you are aware of the fact that, you know, Google, Yahoo, Yandex, Microsoft, and other search engine vendors, alongside the W3C and a community of enthusiasts, have collectively created a project called Schema.org. Now, one of the great things about Schema.org is that it's lowered the threshold for producing structured data, because one of the oversights that sort of dogged the semantic web vision in the very early days is the fact that we can't demand perfection from day one from every participant. We have to take a layered approach and understand that as long as the web is the medium, things are going to be messy. Throw perfection out of the window. And so what Schema.org has been able to do is fill a very important void, which is accelerate participation and production of structured data that's accessible on the web. And this particular form of data is easily transformable into what is often referred to as five-star linked open data, where all of the principles that I outlined earlier on about denotation, i.e. making these digital identifiers function like terms, are adhered to. Now, the thing about schema.org is that if you're on the other side of the fence, i.e. you're not an individual who's just simply happy to be able to produce structured data on the web using syntax that isn't necessarily that intimidating to you because it's presented to you as, you know, an extension of HTML tags, be it microdata or RDFA, for instance. So if you don't fall into that profile, and you're someone who's already been contributing data to the linked open data cloud, for instance, or you started to build solutions that hook into the linked open data cloud, here is a typical integration conundrum that hits you immediately. On one axis, you have the might of Google accelerating the production of structured data. And as of this time, I actually find it really difficult to find sites that are not publishing structured data in microdata formats, microdata form with Google search engine optimization in mind. So everybody is doing it. Every major site I know of has started to adhere to these structured data publication principles, primarily in response to Google.
5 minutes.
Okay. So the problem is, if you have all of these individuals, for instance, let's take a simple organization. So schema.org describes an organization. But in the linked open data cloud, you have a collection of data that's somewhere north of 50 billion triples or RDF statements. How do you bring the data that's already been curated that exists in the linked open data cloud and what exists from the schema.org vocabulary? So for instance, there's a definition of an organization in schema.org. How can I use those that definition from schema.org and still get instances of that class from the linked open data cloud? So that's basically what this is about. So the first slide is slide number 12, and I'm saying if you go to the linked open data cloud cache, which we maintain, for instance, it has north of 50 billion triples, and it's live, so anybody can work with it. You can click on any of these images as I speak, and you'll pretty much be going to the real thing. I've hot linked all the images. So here's a description of the organization class from the full vocabulary. Now you can see there are already instances of organizations in this particular Lot Cloud cache. So now we go to slide number 12. And now we're looking at a description of the organization class from schema.org. And as you can see, it's sparse because the ontology is loaded, but there are next to no instances of schema.org organization. So this is a classic data integration challenge. How do you productively, right, bring the data together so that it doesn't matter whether somebody queries for an instance of a FOF organization or an instance of a schema.org organization? They get the same results. So if they want facts about companies, they get all of the facts, a union of the facts. If they want the description of these two classes, they get a union of all of the elements that constitute the class. Here are the properties that all members must have, all right? So this is what this is demonstrating to you, and you should be able to see this live by clicking on the links. So we go to the next slide. The next slide is showing the effect of reasoning. The effect of being able to use a bridging or meta-ontology to assert that the schema.org definition of a class is equivalent to the FOF vocabulary's definition of the same class. So we have an organization in two vocabularies, and we're asserting that they're equivalent. So we use an owl equivalent relation to express that fact, that these two things, these two classes, are equivalent. And so as a result of that, when reasoning is enabled, and that happens in this particular case by simply invoking a rule, so making a rule live. Now, the rules are not live by default. They're enabled conditionally. Next slide. And so here's the same thing, just showing you the same implications of offers defined or described using the schema.org vocabulary, but where instance data is coming from data that's associated with the good relations ontology. So again, good relations is one vocabulary or ontology that describes offers. And schema.org does the same thing. But most of the data has been built using the good relations vocabulary. But through the OWL equivalent class relation, all of the data is available to you irrespective of what you have as the object of an RDF type or instance of relation. Right? And so slide 16, it's about resolving problems amicably. So in my particular case, because the obvious question is, well, Kingsley, what about if I, based on my particular circumstances, don't accept the claim of equivalence between the two classes because of the nature of the work that I'm doing? Then my answer is simple. Don't use those rules. You could make up an alternative set of rules. And when you instantiate those rules, they simply serve as your context lenses. So you're simply looking at the same data, but through your specific context lenses. All right? So use inference rules conditionally. And I'm at slide 17 right now, and that's a little screenshot showing you a rule. And so that rule is enabled or disabled depending on what I'm trying to do. And if I want to look at things differently, I simply create a new rule, I upload it to the system, and if I need it, I select it. That's it. Slide 18, so, you know, we're pretty much at the end of the presentation here. Some additional links, a lot of terms. And now if you click on these links, they're going to take you to a document that I've written by hand. And I wrote this document by hand as testament to what's possible when you have an appropriate notation, one that's very easy to read and write because it isn't far away from writing in natural language. And so when you look at this particular document, you'll notice that if you click on one of these links, you'll resolve to a document that describes data, big data, open data, whatnot. But if you also look closely, you will notice there's an alternative, I think it's an alternative representation relation right at the top, and you can actually see the text version of it. And so when you look at the text, you can actually see how this was all inscribed by hand using Turtle. And then on the final slide, slide 19, again, just, you know, some additional references if you're trying to locate me or anything that OpenLink software does. And I think that's it. Thank you for your time and attention.
Fantastic. Thank you, Kingsley. That was very enlightening, and I think we've done the whole range of thinking now, from the history and common logical language to describe things through to how reasoning can be used. As Amanda just said in the chat, how reasoning gives you a lot more lift out of linked data, and some interesting insights into how to apply that conditionally and so on. So thank you very much, and thank you all of our speakers for bringing together what I think is a wide range of perspectives on the questions we're looking at. So we have just over 15 minutes for open discussion. I think there's a lot of interesting points in the chat, and also I'd like to give my co-champions an opportunity to jump in with ideas and things as well. But let's Let's proceed by way of, if you toggle the little hand to put yourself in the question queue, and let's take a few questions from there to start our discussion going. Does anybody want to start the ball rolling with a question for any of our speakers or clarification on something? I think I'm still digesting the points that have been made. Anybody want to? There's a little hand at the bottom of the list of names there, which when you click on it, your name sort of pops up into the queue. So, Peter Yim, you're on first.
Hi, I have put on the chat to this. I think my the version I have put up for Kingsley's slides, the URLs don't seem to be active. So I just wanted to ask if Kingsley could supply us an update so that I can swap into the archives. So while
all the links, Peter, are in this particular document, and okay. I will update the archives too. Anyway, I'll send you an updated version.
Yeah.
With a live link.
Fantastic. I will.
I just test them one more time. They should all be there. You have to click on the image, by the way. So whenever you see a screenshot, click on the image itself. That's where the hyperlinks are.
Okay, great.
So on slide 18, there are underlined bits of text, but not actually hyperlinks behind them. Great. Gary, you have a question? Gary Birdcroft, star 7?
Yes, can you hear me now?
Yes, we can.
Forgot that old star 7 trick. I wanted to give John Sower an opportunity to say a little bit more in response to some of the questions he got and clarifications about essentially this problem of dealing with the domain experts and how to communicate effectively with them.
Yes, that was a big subject in the chat as well. John, are you... we're not hearing you just yet, but if you start 7 again.
Is that okay?
Yes, that is. Thank you.
Okay. Yes, the issue about communicating effectively with experts, I believe that is the critical issue for making our tools, our ontology tools, usable by the wide range of people. Now, there were some points that were being asked that said, well, it hasn't been my experience that our current tools can can effectively derive knowledge from documents directly without a huge amount of additional knowledge in, built in. And I agree that most current tools today for natural language processing aren't that effective. However, one of the things that we've been doing at VivoMind, and I think there are also some other research projects, have in fact been really doing some very, very good work. And one thing we do is we just take a very limited amount of background knowledge in a relatively plain vanilla underspecified ontology and derive a huge amount of the ontology directly from the document, and then repeatedly go through and deriving and applying that to more ontologies. And what we do is we completely analyze every document. We don't just do keywords. We just analyze, parse the entire documents, translate them to conceptual graphs, and we're really doing deriving the semantics of the whole thing. And that really, really does give you a huge amount of information, and that the only thing that the expert has to do is to answer questions and help correct information. And that is a much, much better way of tailoring things than requiring human beings to sit down and laboriously type in all kinds of stuff, because I don't think that's ever going to get the kinds of things that we need. In effect, what we're doing is filling in the gap between what Psych does and what IBM Watson does. IBM Watson does a huge amount of heuristics and statistics, and Psych does a huge amount of very detailed knowledge representation. What we're doing is filling in the gap in between. If we have a detailed ontology, we can use it. On the other hand, we can do a great deal without any ontology at all. Just take the document, analyze it, you build up a little bit of an ontology, use that to bootstrap your way up, and then have an expert answer questions and help the system as it goes along.
Thanks, John. Amanda Bison, you're up next.
I thought it was very interesting that the conversation sort of went off on this direction of talking about tools, tool interactions with subject matter experts for ontology development and creation. Now, this could, you know, there's a small obvious mapping of that into reuse, which is that when you're evaluating ontologies for possible reuse, it's important to have some subject matter expert vetting for your particular use case, and you may need to fill in some gaps, some expertise to mortar around the ontologies you're reusing, but it's a very small, I think, part of what the challenges to reuse look like. And so, but yet this conversation sort of like seemed to take it for granted. So I put in the chat the question of, you know, can some of the folks who are sort of going off on that or seeing that as a central question unpack why? So I'll throw that as a question, but I'm going to make an observation as well before I let go of the floor, which is that I think that the most common reuse situations that we see right now look like what Kingsley and Michelle presented to us, especially the mapping and partial reuse are really hot, right? And we see lots and lots of projects like what Michelle talked about, where people and Mike Feibel is one of them, where there's a desire to reuse what's out there, but figuring out the practicalities of how to actually do that, both in terms of mapping and in terms of not, you know, wanting to take pieces but not be loaded down by pulling, you know, all of these whole ontologies, potentially very large, into the memory space of a tool or an application context. There's also a tool question there, which is, you know, if our tools are all designed to make big whole ontologies, and we haven't thought maybe enough about modules and partial reuse, then that's something to look at. But I'll just, but it's my observation that those are where the kinds of reuse we see going on most.
So perhaps each of our speakers could briefly comment on that, Amanda, before we go on to the next question.
I'd just like to comment on what Amanda said. And one of the points that we've been doing at VivoMind is not addressing, not even attempting to do what Psych does and trying to take pre-existing ontologies, but rather deriving the ontology we need directly from the task. So there's one example, a very large example, where the ontology was derived from both structured data and unstructured data. The structured data happened to be a whole collection of COBOL programs and various kinds of database specifications and so on, all specified in a formal notation. That notation can be analyzed to extract, analyze that to derive a collection of conceptual graphs that described that as our formal ontology. Then we had the manuals that were written in ordinary English, and we interpreted those manuals in English in terms of the ontology derived from COBOL and the other structured forms. So the structured ontology was derived automatically from there. And then what we did was look for mapping the manuals to the documents, map the comments, map the texts, map the huge number of English texts to those to the programs, search for discrepancies between what the text said and what the programs actually what was in the programs and so on, and then itemize the discrepancies and show where the differences were. Also find strange things in the programs that weren't supposed to be there, and a lot of that. That is one example. The other examples were extracting ontologies from the by reading textbooks and using those ontologies to interpret research reports, and then to answer queries by geologists about the research reports using the information derived from the textbooks in order to interpret the others. Now, that's a kind of thing that we have not addressed the particular task of taking a fixed set of ontologies and building them together. On the other hand, I think we could if we somebody paid us to do that.
Thanks. Michelle and then Kingsley, do you want to each have a crack at this one?
Kingsley here?
Okay, go ahead, Kingsley.
Okay. So one of the issues that has always swirled around, you know, this particular realm is the lack of tools. But unfortunately, what isn't typically clarified is what the capabilities of the tools should actually be. And so I noticed when this question was posed, there was mention about sometimes the size of the data, that, you know, you may be trying to use a specific tool, but the nature of that tool is that it requires all of the definition data and all of the instance data, and in many cases that can overwhelm the system. Now, one of the benefits of linked open data is the fact that you have a number of services that allow you to work with snippets of things. So, for the most part, you can pretty much explore, as my examples show, all sorts of ontologies and instances of classes and, you know, the effects of different relations just through your browser. You don't necessarily have to start trying to load all of the data into a system. I mean, because what you're trying to do more than anything else is just understand how relationships are being represented, be it as instances of a specific ontology. So I'll give you a very simple example. If you look at Facebook, one of the interesting things that Facebook does is it has the like button. Now, to the uninitiated, they don't realize that that is a like relation. But more importantly, and I think, you know, John has alluded to this earlier on, Psyche embarked upon building a common sense ontology for mankind many years ago. And so one of the things that occurred to us when we started this journey was to get in contact with the guys behind Psyche and say, look, if you publish your data in this form and make it part of this burgeoning linked open data cloud, in due course, connections can be made. So for instance, if I want to create a document describing the things I like, I am going to use the like relation as described by OpenPsyche, because it's actually part of the linked open data cloud. But because of my ability to cross-reference, and the fact that Facebook, unbeknownst to many people, actually publishes linked data too, I'm able to simply map these two relation types and say, these are equivalent properties, right? And so whether I say I Facebook-like or OpenPsyche-like, or I just have my own local identifier for like, right? The important thing is that the implications of liking and the fidelity of that kind of relation, meaning, you know, like, you know, there are many levels at which you can like something are now at my disposal because psych gives that to me. You see? And so this is an example of, I don't need everything in psych. I just need a description of something, a particular relation in psych, that I now want to use to create a description. And I think if we look at the tools as being no more than the ability to create a document and look up what's out there through your browser, for the most part, and sort of veer away from thinking you're going to have some tool ingest all the data, perform all the analysis for you, because, you know, that's a short path to hell, I think we can begin to understand the shape and form of tools that we need. And if I was to sum it up right now, what we need is a data wiki, a tool that has all the characteristics of what's so popular in regards to, say, Wikipedia and other wikis. But rather than this system addressing the creation of content in the form of what you see in Wikipedia, this tool simply allows you to curate entity relationships. And that's it. And so even when conflicts arise, at the end of the day, I could describe something, John could differ with it, but in the absolute worst-case scenario, John is able to continue what he's doing, and ultimately we can see why we agree or disagree. You know, the ability to agree to disagree is a virtue that sits right at the core of the web's architecture, you know, the 404, right? So, yeah. So this is where, you know, a data wiki, the ability to curate data is really what we need in terms of defining the kinds of tools that will make us more productive.
Thanks. I hope we're good to go for another 5 minutes. I wanted to give all three speakers a chance to address Amanda's question, and then we have Gary, and then another point from Kingsley as well. So, Professor Duontier, did you also want to briefly come back on Amanda's question?
Yeah, sorry. Can you tell me again what the question is?
Oh, I was hoping you wouldn't ask that. Amanda?
It had to do with the fact that the conversation had gone off on the chat. Now, some of this happened, Michelle, while you were talking, but while you were presenting, but running off on sort of the questions about the problems or challenges and partial solutions to SME interaction with ontology development and creation tools, and seemed like sort of folks were sort of, there was an unstated premise that this is closely related to the challenges to reuse, and so I was asking if folks who were part of that could unpack, you know, in particular what they see that relation as being, and I had made some other suggestions, but we'll leave that off in the interest of time there.
Well, I think the last 7 years I've been trying to sort of, you know, cut my teeth in this whole ontology semantic web stuff. Before that, I had no idea that this world even existed, and it, you know, it took substantial time and effort. And I agree with John that, you know, it's currently, I think, fairly difficult to do these things and do them very well and do them in a way that you are getting sort of immediate feedback on your contribution. So I agree with Kingsley that having some kind of universal data wiki where, you know, we get to see what people have done is going to be important, and to see how, when we want to make a contribution, an information contribution, we can see what the impact is going to be. So one of the reasons that I'm kind of excited of being at Stanford is that I'll have the opportunity to work with Mike Musin. And the hope is, I think, to try to merge the worlds of the terminological development along with the actual data that scientists are producing. And the biocuration activities that people do, which is they read articles, they try to summarize the facts, and then they publish that in databases. So we have raw data, we have curated information from publications, and then we have these top-level terminological distinctions. And none of them are being, I would say, coordinated in such a way that they really follow from one another. There's certainly no pointers between them. So I think if we can figure out a way to make the contributions at these different levels interlinked, then it may inform better terminological development, or certainly some that are more relevant. So I'll give you an example. The gene ontology, which contains like 30,000 terms, the overwhelming vast majority of those terms never appear in text. And they're simply tools by the curators to make categorical distinctions that aren't really used by scientists. So there's a huge discrepancy between what the data are, what the curators think, and what the discourse is about. And I think we need to rectify that. And developing tools that make it, you know, that pull all the content together is one step. But the second step is that those contributions that people make get recognized, and we understand the consequences of doing that, right? That you can run some reasoner and you can say, listen, adding this fact made this difference. And it could be an inconsistency in the knowledge base, or it could be a contribution that adds new entailments, or whatever it's going to be. But that's, we need to work towards something like that.
Thank you. Yeah, that's very interesting, actually, because something I've found in our work in the finance industry, business ontology, is that in order to really follow the kind of rules that John set out about, you know, well-structured logic and abstraction and so on, you end up creating, not just in data, but in the ontology, abstractions which both the business experts and the technical implementers often find disorienting. There must be some middle ground between capturing that business knowledge in a way the business folks can understand, and yet, as we've seen, having stuff you can reason over so that you have well-formed semantics so that you get some lift from it in when you apply it to actual linked data. So I think there's a bit of work to be done there. Anyway, that was just my 5 cents worth. Thanks. Gary, you have the floor.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, so I had a question about ontology design patterns, which have been discussed by previous speakers. And Michelle talked about finding patterns within data, and John talked a little bit about that from VivoMind, also starting with the data. But also, in his presentation, he noted that Psych had a lot of micro-theories. And Kingsley asked the question about where do we start. And so for some of us, ontology design patterns are sort of things that we start with. They could have been found in ground data at one point, but the idea is that they might be good starting points for working forward. So I wanted to get our speaker's opinion about that type of thing.
Well, I'll just mention that what I meant by ontology design patterns are patterns of patterns. They're meta-level patterns of which you can have large numbers of different instances. And so what I had been talking about there was itemizing the various kinds so that you can have a whole range of different. The simplest thing is just the type hierarchy, but you can have open-ended varieties of those things. And I'm not talking about particular instances, but rather the patterns that one would look for when you are trying to find the instances that fit that pattern.
Thanks. Would the other speakers have a one-sentence answer to that question as well? We've got about a minute to go.
Sure. So, again, we also do this with SIO. We define these design patterns, and they largely arise from use cases, you know, from people who join our mailing list who says, how do we represent this kind of information? So that's the one level. But then the ontology also contains design patterns for their concept level descriptions and the relations that hold between them. So we have this really universal model. This is the kinds of relations that hold between certain kinds of objects. When you want to articulate a relation, it should be a subrelation of this or something like that. So I think we need them at both levels, both at the data level patterns to ensure sort of syntactic and structural homogeneity, and then at the ontology level so that you have consistent representation of similar concepts.
Thanks. Kingsley?
So So I think I expressed my position in my presentation. It's a bit of both. And I think it's about realizing that people have different specializations and different motivations in specific circumstances or situations. And so the key is to get things going, and then as you progress, align things. So I really don't have a position about starting with a grant ontology or starting without one. I simply encourage people to, because we all in our heads have some idea of what we're trying to describe. So start a description. And as it progresses, the value of ontologies will manifest at some point in time. Just like if you were building an ontology, the value of actual assumptions based on the terms described in the ontology will also manifest. It's very hard to pick a definitive starting point. I find that unnatural, to be honest with you.
Thank you. Well, thank you all. Again, as we saw in those answers, the breadth of perspectives really give us a lot to think about and a lot of challenges in our quest for reusable semantics and for guidelines and patterns and exemplary content and so on. So we've got a lot to do in our synthesis to pull all this together and make the most of your comments in the communique that we'll be helping with in the ontology summit. So I think with that, it just remains on behalf of myself and my co-champions, Andrea Westbrin and Gary Birdcroft, it just remains to thank Dr. Sowa, Professor Demontier, and Mr. Idahan for their very insightful and deep presentations in this area. So thank you all very much indeed, and thank you everybody for your questions and comments both in sound space and on the textual space of the chat. And thank you very much indeed. With that, I think it's time to wrap up. Peter, Ian, thank you as well, of course.
Thank you all. Great session.
Fantastic. Thanks, Peter.
Bye-bye.
Bye, everyone.